Thank you, Crystal, for that wholesome and kind introduction and to our student years. I'm delighted to be here today. My thanks to Linda Bisello and Carla Mazzarelli for their kind invitation to speak to you today and on the Getty Research Portal. In the last 20 years or so, the possibilities of research have changed profoundly, and it's truly an exciting time to be an historian. The internet has given us unparalleled new access to primary sources, and as far as printed books are concerned, due to copyright laws, they can be more widely available than comparatively recently published books. As anyone who has tried to locate an online copy of a book from, let's say, the 1970s can attest. With digitized books, we have speed and convenience of access and the ease of being able to search texts. To younger historians, this may be the norm, but this miracle of access was brought home to all of us during the pandemic when digital libraries remained available while the doors of physical libraries were shut. This was of enormous value to me personally, as I was completing the catalogue for the 2022 Getty exhibition, Flesh and Bones, The Art of Anatomy. And I was able to check editions, clear up bibliographical puzzles, read texts, and zoom in on details of illustrations. From the catalogue, on the left, these are details of two late 18th century prints. On the left, by Arnaud Eloy Gauthier d'Agouti, the son of Jacques Fabien, a color mezzotint after Albinus, which omits the famous rhinoceros in the background. And on the right, after one of Ercole Lenni's Spallati from the Anatomy Theater in Bologna, a life-size figure composed of several prints by Antonio Cattani. In tandem with the exhibition, a virtual collection of digitized books of anatomy and art was created on the Getty Research Portal, together with a related research guide on the library website. Links to both can be found at the easily remembered getty.edu/anatomy. This evening, I will discuss some of these books as I demonstrate how the portal works, and at the same time, I will be considering the effects that digitization can have on our perception and understanding of them. A touchstone will be Andreas Vesalius's De Humani Corporis Fabrica of 1543, which had a sustained impact on the early history of anatomical illustration through the innumerable copies made after it. Tonight, any title with an asterisk denotes comparative material not on the portal. Launched in 2012, the Getty Research Portal is an online platform providing global access to digitized resources for the literature of art and to illustrated books. These can be viewed through the portal and entire books or individual pages downloaded. The aim is to provide free, open, and unified access. The portal, additionally, is always a useful place to begin a search for a digital copy of a book related to art, and given the interdisciplinary nature of the history of art, it's also a resource for a wide range of subjects, including the sciences. The portal combines content from a growing range of institutions through a unified single search interface. As of last year, there were 45 contributing institutions, most of them art libraries. In Italy, for example, there is the Tati Library, the Biblioteca Herziana, and the Kunsthistorisches Institut in Florence. The portal is hosted by the Getty Research Institute in Los Angeles, the semicircular building seen on the right. The Getty Center Museum is on the left. The Getty Research Institute, or GRI, has one of the premier art history libraries in the world with a wide collecting scope. It also hosts residential visiting scholars, has a publication program, and maintains art-related databases like the portal. Thematic virtual collections are a way to bring awareness to the depth of holdings on a subject. Accessible via a link on the portal's main page, you can find collections, for example, on botany, alchemy, and early photography. The portal's anatomy and art collection is comprised of 128 records and spans the 16th to the early 20th centuries, focusing specifically on books with illustrations of human anatomy. A great advantage of the portal is being able to directly access a book in its entirety. Anatomical illustration can sometimes take on a life of its own, often being used as a shorthand for art and science, or else a selection of images can be presented as a placeholder for the whole book. But I firmly believe that you cannot properly consider an image out of context from its original text. So now that you know that art libraries are a good place to look for illustrated anatomy books, let's have a glance at how the portal functions. In this view, the collection has been sorted by date. There are further options on the left for refinements such as author, language, and date range, and variables such as author or keyword can be simply added to the search field. At the top of the list is the earliest book in the collection, the Geddes copy of the Isagoge I Brevis of 1521 by the Bolognese surgeon and anatomist Jacopo Berengario de Carpi. His books on anatomy, published in the early 1520s, were the most extravagantly illustrated books on that subject to yet appear. Keep in mind that in the era before print, anatomy was described mainly in words rather than in images. And so Berengario's little book with 23 woodcut illustrations is quite a landmark. On the portal, there are multiple access points to the scan of the book, directly from the search list, from within the entry itself, and from a link, in this case, to the Internet Archive at the top of the page. The portal entries are composed of a restricted set of fields that do not necessarily include information like provenance and size, and so I recommend checking the catalog of the main holding library for this. Berengario's illustrations served as a direct model for the Flemish anatomist Andreas Vesalius and his De Humani Corporis Fabrica, prepared in Padua but published in Basel in 1543. The enduring topos of the animated cadaver, appearing in a landscape setting and thus part of the living world, was firmly established in the illustrations to Berengario's Commentary on Mondinus of 1521 and the editions of the Isagoge I Brevis that followed. From contemporary accounts, we know that Berengario was considered a knowledgeable art connoisseur. He was a patron of the sculptor Benvenuto Cellini, and he once requested and received a painting by Raphael in lieu of payment. Berengario's remarkable concern for the illustrations is indicated by the large amount of revisions and new illustrations, such as the vertebrae, the heart, the uterus, added in later editions. He kept tinkering with the book to improve it, regardless of effort and expense. Vesalius also made changes to the illustrations in the second edition of the Fabrica, but to a lesser extent. However, he far surpassed Berengario in fully grasping the potential of an image to explicate and support the text, employing hundreds of references to them. The Fabrica featured over 200 illustrations, 10 times the amount of the Isagoge I Brevis, and in their quality, number, and size, they set the standard for luxury anatomy atlases to follow. As you know, when working with the digital copies, all objects potentially become the same size, the size of your screen. And I think Gideon is to be applauded for earlier giving us a physical indication of the size of the edition of Albinus that he consulted. As these scaled openings demonstrate, Berengario's Isagoga brevis on the left is half the size of Isaias's folio and less than a quarter in length. Berengario's book was intended as a handy textbook, being written in response, according to the title page, to requests from his students, so portability and length were considerations. The copy of the Fabrica that I show you is the one in the GRI, the only copy of that edition on Internet Archive so far. For other digitized copies of the first as well as the second editions of the Fabrica, I refer you to the Vesalius Census website at the above link. A major factor contributing to the Fabrica's dimensions is that Vesalius had a stated preference for large illustrations. In his letter to his Basel publisher, Johannes Operinus, Vesalius complained about reduced copies of his Tabulae Sex of 1538, saying that, as far as he was concerned, illustrations could never be made large enough for students. Maintaining the scale from the previous slide, even larger than Vesalius's Fabrica was his Epitome on the right, a compendium of anatomy published at the same time, and the largest 16th century illustrated book on anatomy to have appeared until then. Larger also than the Fabrica was his Tabulae Sex. The first leaf, which shows the liver, portal vein, and the male and female generative organs, is one of three woodcuts based on drawings by Vesalius. The other three of skeletons were after drawings by Jan Steven van Kolkar, a Netherlandish artist active in Italy in Titian's circle. This copy of the Tabulae Sex in the University of Glasgow is one of only two complete copies surviving, the second being in the Biblioteca Marciana in Venice. The photograph of the Canadian physician and bibliophile, Sir William Osler, holding the Glasgow copy, gives you an idea of its scale. Given the rarity of the Tabulae Sex, it was understandably not well known before facsimiles were made of the two copies. Albrecht von Haller did not mention it in his Bibliotheca Anatomica of 1774, and Ludwig Schulon, the author of an important survey of anatomical illustration of 1852, mentioned earlier by Gideon, had not seen a copy in person. On the left is the first facsimile of the Tabulae Sex made of the Glasgow copy in 1874, and on the far right, a facsimile of the Venice copy that appeared in the Iconis publication of 1934. In terms of granting greater availability of rare books, there is a parallel to appreciate between facsimiles and today's digitized copies. But there's also a distinction to be made. These particular facsimiles, ones most familiar to generations of scholars through reprints, are not, as one would expect, exact copies, but rather they show tidier versions in an aim to approach the original state. The hand coloring of the Glasgow copy has been erased, as has the inscriptions on the Venice copy. In both, the print quality is improved, and gone are the folds, stains, and losses. And there can be misleading additions, like the plate number in the Glasgow facsimile at the bottom right. And here I wish to acknowledge Moritz Biesbroek's analysis of these facsimiles on his Vesalius website, which brought these changes to my attention. With scans, we gain a sense of the materiality of the original book. Here is an opening screenshot of the Getty's copy of the Fabrica, owned in the 19th century by the Scottish bibliophile, politician, and art historian, Sir William Stirling Maxwell, who also owned the Glasgow Tabulae Sex. We see his magnificent bookplate designed for this copy and one which takes full advantage of its folio size. There are also his notes discussing the question of Jan van Kerkhove as the unnamed illustrator of the Fabrica, and his comments on the title page and other illustrations. The importance of materiality should caution one against allowing one digitized copy to stand in for all. Of the around 270 copies of the first edition of the Fabrica in public collections, two are on the portal, which hosts multiple copies of editions when available in an acknowledgement of the potential information that can be gleaned from examining different physical copies. Margot Shi, Somers, and Joffe's recent invaluable census of the first and second editions of the Fabrica tracks who owned the book and what caught its readers' attention. Their analysis of inscriptions and provenance gives us a fascinating window into how the Fabrica was received and valued in different periods. The history of anatomical illustration is one of innovation, but it is also very much a story of copies and adaptations, which can be fascinating in and of itself. On the right is Domenico Bonoveri's Notomia di Tiziano, likely produced for Bolognese Artist Academy, active in the late 1680s, which enjoyed the patronage of Senator Francesco Ghislieri, to whom the book is dedicated. Bonoveri's engravings, in reverse of the Fabrica skeleton and muscle figures, offered, as he says, for the use of those who draw, are without any explanatory text, demonstrating that the visual example of anatomy alone could be deemed sufficient for the use of artists. With no mention of the Salius at all, Bonoveri packages the engravings under Titian's name, both on the title page and with a new inscription on the plinth. Although earlier sources ascribe the Visalian illustrations to Jan Stephen van Kerkhove, here the name of Titian, a far more famous and revered artist, is used to increase the appeal to artists. The name of Kerkhove or even Vesalius might not have been familiar to them, but they would certainly have known of Titian and his success. In copies and adaptations, the Vesalian illustrations were almost immediately separated from their original text. This is indicated in a small part by the examples that one can find doing a search on Vesalius's name within the portal collection. The Vivae Margines of 1566, issued by Christophe Plantin's Antwerp Press, is an early example in one chain of copies that lead back to the illustrations in the Spanish anatomist Juan Valverde de Amuscos' Historia de la Composición del Cuerpo Humano, first published in Rome 10 years prior in 1556. For his edition, Plantin copied the engravings from the 1559 Italian translation and, for a shorter text, turned to a translation of the Epitome. The end result, which, although is catalogued under Vesalius's name, is a composite book at a distance from its author. In Valverde's and in the engraved copies by Geminis, published in London just 2 years after the appearance of the Fabrica, the elaborate landscapes of the Vesalian muscle men have been reduced to a ground line, and because engraving does not allow for intertext illustrations as easily as woodcuts, these have been grouped together separate from the text. In this example, woodcuts of the abdominal dissections and the male urogenital system in anterior and posterior view, testicles and section kidneys now appear all on one plate. Valverde's reuse of the Vesalian illustrations caused him to be considered a plagiarist of Vesalius, even in his own day, while Valverde, for his part, considered his book an improvement in offering a more succinct and straightforward corrected text. And for a subtle appreciation of Valverde's engagement with Valverde, I recommend Cynthia Klesnik's excellent essay from 2005. As far as the illustrations are concerned, in addition to a handful of remarkable new ones, Valverde made selective changes to some of the woodcut originals. Regarding this, he explains that Vesalius' figures were so well done that it would seem envious and or malignant not to use them, and in doing so, it would be easier to indicate where he concurred or disagreed with Vesalius. One change is the relative position of the kidneys. So in the human body, the left kidney is usually slightly higher than the right, due to the position of the liver on the right side of the body. However, Galen and Aristotle, who based their observations on non-human anatomy, state that the right kidney is higher, which is how it is shown in the Fabrica, even though Vesalius comments that the left is sometimes higher and that it, in fact, happens more often than professors of anatomy say. Eustachius, in 1564, rejects Galen and Aristotle's view, but acknowledges variability in his text and significantly in his images. In reverse to Vesalius, Valverde simply states that the left is usually higher and sometimes the right. And furthermore, he adjusts Vesalius' illustrations accordingly. Valverde was probably influenced by the opinion of his teacher, Rialdo Colombo, who in his De Re Anatomica of 1559 cites Galen for getting the arrangement of the kidneys right as far as animal anatomy is concerned, but utterly wrong for human anatomy. Colombo observes, if animals are dissected, it will be seen that Galen did not write these things rashly. In them, the left kidney is exceeded by the right, while in man, the opposite is observed. There is no time this evening to consider this issue in depth, which in some respects is similar to the earlier debate and depiction of the rete mirabile, a net of arteries in the brain that do not appear in humans. I've been looking at the evolution of kidney illustration from Vesalius on, but this evening I will just leave you with the modern conception with the higher left kidney from this recent edition of Gray's Anatomy. Before leaving this slide, I will just point out a quirk of the portal. When microfilm appears in brackets in the title and the loan institution is given as Princeton University Library, this actually denotes a scan of a microfilmed original in the Vatican Library, which purchased Count Leopoldo Cicognara's library on the literature of art in 1824. The microforms date from a campaign in the 1980s on the Cicognara project. And the Cicognara project, another virtual collection within the portal, now aims to recreate the Count's library with scans of the microforms complemented by searchable scans of variant copies from contributing libraries. The last two books in the search results are both 17th century anatomy books of artists, of anatomy books for artists. And this leads to a consideration as to why there are anatomy books in art libraries and why publications on anatomy specifically for artists exists and what distinguishes them. Illustrated anatomy books form part of the history of the print, and this gives one reason for their presence in art libraries. The Fabrica, as well as an important marker in the history of science, is an exceptional example of the interweaving of text and image and of mid-16th century book illustration. Some books represent the work of specific artists, while in the case of Vesalius, the artists and cutters he worked with are not named. From signatures, we know that the illustrations of nerves in the tabulae anatomicae on the right are after drawings by the 17th century artist Pietro da Cortona and were engraved by Luca Ciambolano around 1618 to 20, although not published until the mid-18th century in Rome, when the plates were rediscovered. The original text does not survive, and we do not know with certainty who commissioned these plates. The great fame that Ortona would achieve in his career after this youthful work is acknowledged on the title page, where these illustrations are credited as having been drawn by the celebrated painter Pietro Berrettini of Cortona, preceding the name of Gaetano Petrioli, who provided the commentary. Here I show Cortona's magnificent ceiling frescoes from the Palazzo Pamphili in Rome, done over 30 years after he drew the nerve figures. In contrast to Vesalius, the 17th century Dutch anatomist and surgeon Govard Biddle credited his artist, Gerard de la Ressa, on the title page of his Anatomia Humani Corporis of 1685, noting there that the figures were drawn ad vivum, or from life, which in this case meant portraying anatomized body parts on the dissection table rather than as living figures gambling in a landscape. The desire for fidelity to life extended to the choice of rendering most of the preparations in life size. The result is an enormous book, 55 centimeters in height with 105 plates. When using a digital scan, you lose the physical impact of the book. One aspect of that is the shock of seeing a life-size dissected body laid out in front of you. On the other hand, there's a real benefit in not having to lift the book, which can be quite a workout. Like the Fabrica, Biddle's Anatomia was in Cicognara's collection, a reflection of the fact that Loresa was a successful artist and a noted art theorist. He suffered from congenital syphilis, and the saddle nose in his self-portrait at the top right is symptomatic of this disease, which would be the cause of his blindness just 5 years after the publication of Biddle's book. Loresa then devoted himself to lecturing on art, and his written works may also be accessed on the portal. The main reason for a wide range of anatomy books in art libraries is that the subject of anatomy was a basic component of artistic education for hundreds of years. Parallel to a new study of anatomy in the Renaissance that saw a rigorous consideration of ancient texts against the evidence of human dissection, artists were also studying anatomy, but to a different end. Together with life drawing and copying after the antique, a solid grasp of anatomy was considered the best way for an artist to perfect the representation of the human figure, as exemplified famously in his time by Michelangelo, whose nudes were considered to reflect a supreme understanding of anatomy, and whose own study of anatomy by dissection, both human and animal, was reported in early sources and served as a model to follow. His nudes in the Sistine Chapel were admired and studied, even though he was criticized for indecorously applying the same magnificent muscular body to all his figures, regardless of gender or age, with Lodovico Dolce providing an early example of this in 1557 in his dialogue on art Laurentino. From literary, documentary, and visual evidence, we know that 16th century artists joined anatomists in carrying out or observing dissections. They made drawings after these and models of figures flayed to expose the muscles, and also consulted and even owned anatomy books. These pursuits are celebrated in this imaginary anatomy lesson, showing Michelangelo is seated at the center, dissecting knife in hand, surrounded by identifiable artists of the day. This drawing by the 16th century Bolognese artist Bartolomeo Passerotti has been connected to a project of a book of anatomy by him for artists, described in 1584 by Raffaello Borghini. Like those planned by Leonardo and Michelangelo, it was never completed. Likewise, the Florentine artist Alessandro Allori had attempted an illustrated work on anatomy for artists in the form of a dialogue, of which several drafts survive in the Biblioteca Nazionale in Florence. On the left are related hand studies by him, and below his cancelled owner inscription from a copy of the Fabrica now in Trieste. With the founding of the first formal art academies in the late 16th century, provisions for the teaching of anatomy were made in their early statutes, and these prints of art academies from around the same period demonstrate how fundamental this subject was considered to the education of the young artist. Once in the curriculum of art academies, anatomy remained there until the waning of the academic system in the earlier 20th century, which coincided with the rise of non-figural art. The defining feature of the virtual collection on the portal is that, as well as mainstream anatomy atlases, it gathers together that might not otherwise be found easily, such as drawing manuals and art treatises with anatomical content, as well as anatomy books specifically for artists. A selection of these can be accessed in a library research guide on the GRI website. And in the last segment of this talk, I'll show you a few examples of early drawing manuals with anatomy, and then look at anatomy books for artists, which first appear in the second half of the 17th century. Aimed at both artists and amateurs, printed drawing manuals provided examples to copy and to learn from. Often without text, they can include a wide variety of subjects, though they generally start with individual parts of the body and progress to faces and whole figures, and sometimes include anatomy. This is the Scuola Perfetta per imparare a disegnare tutto il corpo umano from the early 17th century, based primarily on the work of the Bolognese artist Agostino Carracci, who died in 1602. At the top right, we see the signature of the engraver Luca Ciambrolano, cleverly being drawn by the hand holding a pen, the kind of visual joke that Carracci excelled in. I mean, the rebus at the bottom of the sheet being another. This is the same Ciambrolano who would also work on the Tabulae Anatomicae with Pietro da Cortona. Some anatomy examples in drawing manuals are after surviving drawings, like this study of the knee bones next to a leg by Michelangelo in the collection of Christ Church College, Oxford. In the print from the Scuola Perfetta, the leg appears divided into two parts of the sheet because the scale of the drawing has been maintained. The Livre de Portraiture by the French artist Jean Cousin, first published in Paris in 1595, and appeared in numerous editions, and it had several woodcuts of anatomy, some inspired by the Fabrica. Up to and including this edition of 1671, the related text was purely concerned with proportions. This torso is described as divided into three head measures, and no explanation of the muscles is given. The publisher Jolin felt more was needed, and with his edition of 1685, offered, according to the title page, an exact description of the bones and muscles of the human body and their function and use. The figures still maintain their proportional divisions, but new lettering has been added, and there is new explanatory text identifying the muscles and their functions. Cousin's book was tremendously long-lived, with editions under varying titles into the 19th century, which is a long time to be a formative influence on drawing style. Through examples on the portal, you can observe its evolution through time. On the right, descended from Cousin's original 16th century woodcuts, are the, to me, less exciting lithograph versions from the 24th edition of the 1820s. An example of the advantage of being able to check multiple copies of the same edition on the portal is the French artist Jean de Saint-Igny, Element de Portraiture, published in 1630. Of the three copies on the portal, only the one in the INHA in Paris has a series of flayed figures elegantly posed in detailed landscapes, but appearing without explanatory text. The figure on the left, with outstretched arms and a flowing cape, sports a Van Dyck beard and luxuriant locks, possibly a wig. He is the anatomical counterpart to the figures of fashion in Le Jardin de la Noblesse Francoise, published the previous year and to which Saint-Igny contributed. The addition of hair to the already uncanny image of a living flake figure in a landscape was something already seen in Berengario in the 1520s. It is not surprising that when the first anatomy books, specifically for artists, appear, they are often linked to academies as they answered a didactic need of their curriculum. Although there were a few earlier anatomy books that cross-marketed to artists and to surgeons, like Van der Graaf's of 1634, the Abrégé d'Anatomie, published in 1668, was solely for the use of artists. Dedicated to the Académie Royale in Paris, it has engravings by François Tortebat after Vesalius's Fabrica and Epitome, with a preface anonymously penned by the artist and art critic, Roger de Pille. The book promises to present only the essentials of anatomy relevant to artists, being the bones and muscles, in an easy-to-understand package. Its themes of brevity, simplicity, and the promise that a short course of study of anatomy would benefit the artist for his entire career are consistently echoed in books that would follow. For de Pille, the Vesalian illustrations were most correct and impossible to improve upon. His earlier attribution of them to Titian, quickly taken up by Bonnevere, touched off a debate about Vesalius's artists that would last centuries. The consensus today rests with Van Kalkar, whom Vesalius worked on with the tabulae sex. And he was likely a part of a team of artists, including woodcutters. The use of muscle figures from the Epitome helped with the stated aim of brevity in the Abrégé, since these show an ingenious bisected arrangement with a deeper dissection on one side of the body. To make the borings more seamless, the figures from the Fabrica have been enlarged to match the dimensions of the Epitome, and landscape backgrounds from the Fabrica have been added to the Epitome figures as we see here. I find this one of the most affecting of all of the Vesalian figures. Its downward glance and the one eye without lids appearing wide open give it an emotive pensiveness and a real psychological presence. Another benefit of using Epitome figures is the avoidance of those Fabrica figures in which Vesalius purposely inserted non-human anatomy in order to show Galen's errors. Tortebat's copy of the Epitome figure shows the insertion of the rectus abdominis muscle in the middle of the rib cage, but in the Fabrica, it runs up the length of the torso and inserts at the first rib, as it does in animals, with the lower insertion point in humans marked with an R. De Pille was likely aware of this, as it is the first muscle he discusses related to this plate, and one to which he devotes the longest explanation. The Adam and Eve figures from the Epitome have also been given backgrounds from the Fabrica. And this is the first demonstration of the contiguous nature of the backgrounds of the Thessalian muscle figures when reversed. Before leaving the Abergé, I wanted to show you some unusual doodles in this copy in the Getty. The larger one on the half title appears to be a religious procession. Figures carry crosses and what might be torches or palms or penitential whips. They also carry a body on a stretcher. Perhaps this records a lay confraternity carrying a body away from a site of execution to burial. Those condemned to death would be escorted to their execution and then buried by such lay confraternities in the early modern period. And I would welcome hearing your interpretations of this and the other doodle on the right from the main title page, which might have been easier to interpret when before the page was trimmed. Some 10 years after the Abergé, Carlo Cesi's Cognizione dei Muscoli del Corpo Umano per il Disegno was published in Rome in 1679. Cesi, a printmaker, was active in the Accademia di San Luca in Rome, taught its anatomy course, and later served as its director. In terms of number of editions, Cesi's was the most successful of all anatomy books for artists, with 12 editions and into the early 19th century. Many of them, like the one on the left of 1759, were based on Johann Daniel Preissler's translation, first done for his Nuremberg Art Academy in 1706. Like others of this genre, Cesi's book focuses on the bones and muscles alone, structural elements of the body visible on its surface. He promotes the knowledge of anatomy as vital for those who, he says, want to follow a sure path to painting and sculpture. What sets Cesi's book apart are the original non-Vesalian figures, which show the bones of the joints next to the muscle figure in the same pose. In this way, he offers artists the anatomical foundation of a pose. On questions of anatomy, Cesi says he consulted Vesalius and also got the expert advice of his contemporary, the surgeon Bernardino Genga, who's later documented as professor of anatomy at the French Academy in Rome. It was there that Genga and the surgeon Giovanni Maria Lancisi collaborated with Charles Erard, the director of the Academy, on this glorious book, Anatomia per uso ed intelligenza del disegno, which features a series of engraved plates of famous antique sculptures considered anatomically or fictively played. Also included are views of a plaster cast that was taken directly from a dissection for the Academy. And this relates to Academy statutes that called for a mold to be taken of the dissection that was to be done each winter for the benefit of the painters and sculptors. With the final example this evening, we continue our themes of size and rarity. John Walker's The Artist's Pocket Companion, being a compendious treatise of anatomy adapted to the arts of designing, painting, and sculpture. This edition was published in London in 1787. As its title suggests, at 15 centimeters in height, it was small enough to be kept in a pocket and consulted at will. The installation shot from the Getty exhibition with the Walker on the left shows just how small it is relative to other books of the same genre. Its soiled pages hint at its use, and the end leaves have manuscript notes on the muscles. It was once in the collection of the art historian Ulrich Middeldorf, whose papers are now housed in the GRI. This opening with a reversed version of the first muscle figure from the fabric on the right demonstrates the lingering influence of the Thessalian images more than 200 years on. The book was produced for the use of artists at the Royal Academy of Arts in London and was based on a book of much larger dimensions by the printmaker John Tinney of 1743 with plates after Vesalius and William Cooper. A first edition of Walker's book is unknown, and the Getty's copy of the second edition is one of three that exist as far as I know. Yet, as of 2016, the year that a digitized copy was uploaded, it is now available to anyone with a screen. In this way, the rarest of copies can potentially become ubiquitous and familiar. Given previous limited availability, it's not surprising that Walker's book has gone relatively unnoticed. But even this book, least spectacular in size and quality, being comprised of copies, is compelling not just for the afterlife of the original images, but also because it contains an eyewitness record of a riveting moment in the history of art and anatomy that has to do with the 18th century Scottish anatomist and man midwife William Hunter. On the left is a print after a drawing by the engraver Anthony Walker, the uncle of the author, from when he was a young artist studying in the St. Martin's Lane Academy in London. At the time, Hunter was lecturing artists on anatomy there. Around 1750, together with his brother John, Hunter obtained the body of an executed criminal hung at Tyburn. After setting it in a raised arm pose, they flayed it when rigor mortis set in, working through the night in order to have a mold taken of it the next morning while still stiff in its pose. The resultant cast was later moved to the Royal Academy of Arts, and we see it in Zoffany's painting of Hunter lecturing anatomy, where the living model duplicates its raised arm pose. With Walker's print, as with Bidloo, but on a much smaller scale, we have an ad vivum record of a dissected body, one offered here specifically for the study of artists, curiously unique in the company of these much diluted copies. And with that, I thank you for allowing me to share with you the treasures of the Getty portal, both large and small.